Hello and welcome to Preparing Foster Youth for Adulting, the podcast designed to highlight strategies and resources that help youth in care transition to adulthood successfully. Our guests today are Hope Broomham, Director of Programs at Jim Riley Outreach in Plano, Texas, and Andrea Slider, Chief Operating Officer with the Right Way Foundation in Los Angeles, California. Welcome, Hope and Andrea. How are you both doing today?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Doing well, thank you.
Fantastic. Well, I am very glad that you could join this conversation today that we're having on how do you help young people aging out of foster care find and maintain employment? And I know you both work with organizations that do that with young people. So what I'd like to start with is an opportunity for you both to introduce yourselves, your organization, and what you do. And then after that, we'll start having the conversation about this. So, Andrea, how about if I start with you?
Good afternoon. My name is Andrea Slider. I am Chief Operating Officer with an organization in Los Angeles called the Right Way Foundation. And the Right Way Foundation supports transition age foster youth with employment, mental health, and housing.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. I will also give a shout out to Franco Vega, who's the executive director of your organization, because he's on the board of Aging Out Institute, and he's awesome.
Yes, that's awesome.
All right. Hope, how about you?
Yes. So my name is Hope. I work with Jim Riley Outreach, and we provide transitional housing for youth 18 to 25 that have either aged out of foster care or are homeless without other critical supports. We have two homes, one for young women and one for young men, and we can house three youth at each location.
And do you also provide support for young people in the employment area?
Yes. All the residents that are in our program are required to work, and so we assist them with writing a cover letter if they have never done that, and also making a resume if that's new to them as well, and then encourage them on just tips and tricks for the job search process.
I think that's not uncommon for organizations to have that kind of requirement that, you know, if you're going to be participating, you have to be in school or you have to be employed, something like that. All right, so let's dive into the conversation today. I really want to find out first from you, with the work that you do, what would be the biggest challenges when you're working with these young folks insofar as helping them find a job? Let's start there. Just getting a job. What are the biggest challenges?
I would say the things that I've noticed are, you know, depending on their level of experience, if they've never had a job before, I think some employers are looking for experience to hire, but if you don't have any experience, how are you supposed to get experience? So I think there should be some flexibility, you know, and again, there's always kind of the McDonald's or the entry-level jobs, but a lot of them want to start off with something else. And so just trying to find the balance of, you know, how do they get a job that they feel was a great first step while also recognizing that they don't have a lot of experience and that that's something that they need to grow in.
Yeah. I know years ago, apprenticeships were big. Mm-hmm. Now we're talking decades ago, right? Apprenticeships were really big. Do you think that should be an avenue that companies should consider as opposed to just expecting necessarily a college degree?
I think it would be a great avenue. I've seen a little bit of resurgence of kind of the trades coming back as well, encouraging, you know, like the electrician, the plumber. A lot of the schools in our area, the community colleges are offering certifications in those areas, which we try to encourage our residents to do. I think it just depends on each resident has a unique career path and thing that they want to pursue. So trying to match the opportunity with the desire of what the resident is interested in. But there's organizations that have, I think there's a few in our area that offer like an IT certification where you can learn and kind of have an internship in that. I think there's also one on automotive care and things in that area. So I think the opportunities are out there. You have to look for them a little bit. I think it's a great option for sure.
And I imagine you have to work with each individual young person to map out what they would need to get in order to reach their employment goals.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So you have to like, oh, okay, you want to be, you know, what? Let's say what's really common, a YouTube influencer, right? Let's just throw that one out there because I know a lot of young people want to do that.
Yeah.
Well, you have to learn certain things mm-hmm. to be able to do that. It's not just jumping on, you know, your stream and hoping that it works. The really successful influencers, they put a lot of time into that. and they have editing skills, or they find people with editing skills. So even that, you have to do some mapping.
Yes, mm-hmm. I agree.
Andrea, how about you? What would you say is one of the biggest challenges that you see with young people just finding a job?
I think, like Hope, it's just knowing where to start. And similarly to what Hope is saying, it's just helping young people navigate that process. So, and similarly what you said, which is figuring out exactly what they want to do and what direction they're headed in. Or if they don't have an idea, kind of expose them to what's out there, right? Because half the battle time is making that decision. I think the preparation piece, and I'm sorry to plug our program a little bit, but that's
no, go for it.
What we do essentially, right, is we do the preparation and the maintenance for like, what do you do to keep your job? What do you do to retain your job? So the preparation piece is all of the essential skills, like what Hope is saying about interviewing and resume writing and applications, and really just like an introduction to how do I approach these things. And then, you know, having opportunity to practice regularly. So we offer one-on-one job coaching, so those skills can be more refined. And then we'll continue to work with them as needed to get that first job, if that's the case, or route them into a vocational training program, a trade, right? Because we understand that not everybody has the desire to go to college, or might not be ready to go to college in that moment. So just
meeting
people where they're at, you know, working with them.
Yeah. I don't want to disparage college degrees by any means. However, more and more I'm hearing that young people are graduating with degrees and they're just not able to find a job with that degree, or they're not getting as much money as they thought they would. And I just think with the demand that's out there in the trades, because there's so many people retiring from the trades that they need to fill those spots, right? They need young people to come in, and there aren't that many young people going into the trades. Well, you get a job in the trades, you're pretty much set as long as you focus and get good at it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the trades is a great way to go. It's not the only way to go. Like I said, I don't want to disparage college degrees. It does a lot as far as increasing your, you know, your lifetime income. But that said, you know, I just want to also encourage the trades. But one of the things that I wanted to ask, going back to just helping young people find their first job, or at least a foot in the door toward a career, how do your organizations provide exposure to different career paths? Because I can't imagine at 18, you would know what all the possibilities are. So how do you do that?
I would say one of the things that we do is provide internship opportunities. And I mean, let me go backwards a little bit too, is, you know, we have job developers on our team who build relationships with employment partners, potential employment partners. So they have their work cut out for them to work with employers and local businesses to encourage these opportunities. You know, they're promoting our organization. They're promoting the young adults in our organization, saying, hey, this is oftentimes their first time job. You know, and there are lots of local businesses that are really interested in supporting and helping foster youth with that, you know, with that first job opportunity. So it's really like getting them to get on board and creating those internship opportunities, and then leveraging, you know, internship dollars to place them in these, you know, various businesses to expose them to maybe a potential career option. So that's one way. That's one way to do it. If they're not quite ready for that, if maybe they are in school or maybe they are in some kind of training and maybe not ready for that full first-time job, but we're kind of working our way in that direction, I think internships are a good opportunity to build those skills and to give people confidence, you know, in the workspace.
That's true.
Yeah.
When you were getting started, how did you convince the first few businesses to partner with you? I imagine once you have a few signed up, that's a little easier. But how do you convince businesses to do this and take the chance, right? Because there are so many preconceived notions about young people coming out of foster care. How do you get past that?
Yeah, I think, you know, this is where I have to give credit to Franco. Like you said, he's awesome because he, you know, he's the one that really paved the way for employment opportunities. And he actually used his previous relationships with employers that he had fostered over the years, you know, to really present to them like, hey, we have this organization, we're working with foster youth. These kids are amazing. They're resilient, they're driven, they're ambitious, they want this. And so they just need to be given an opportunity, you know, somebody who's willing to give them that first job, you know, maybe somebody who, maybe an employer partner who was like, no, these people, they need experience. Our employees need experience. Promoting it in such a way, it's like, no, we want to give them this first opportunity, you know, for their first job. So that was definitely what Franco brought to the table. And then what we did several years back was we created a training. It was a trauma-informed healing center training where we were teaching our employer partners and educating our employer partners on how to support people in the workplace who've experienced trauma. So it could be anybody, not just foster youth, but it could just be anybody who's experienced trauma. And so we put our employer partners through a 6 to 8 hour training. We realize that's a hefty time commitment, but they're all willing to do it. What we do is we kind of highlight, you know, it's sort of an introduction to what trauma looks like, right? Or what could it could potentially look like, how it could impact people, specifically in a workplace setting. And then we give them tools to create a safe space where they can build healthy relationships and trusting relationships with their employees and, you know, with young adults who are coming out of foster care. And so I think that's definitely a, you know, another selling point to that. And then providing that ongoing support to both employees and young adults, right? That kind of mutual support. Like if the employer is, you know, how do I navigate the situation? We're available to provide that support to our employer partners. And then equally as important is being able to provide that support to young adults if they're experiencing challenges that are potentially a barrier to them retaining that job. You know, providing support on both ends is really
right.
Yeah.
I bet that helps a lot that they know they're not out there on a limb by themselves.
Yeah.
They've got you backing them up.
For sure. For sure.
The youth and the employers, like you're saying.
Absolutely. Yeah.
That's great. Hope, does your organization, I know not all orgs do, but does your organization have that kind of like an employment partnership type of approach?
Yeah. So it's actually something that we just have looked into this past year to launch. And I was thinking about your question of like, that's what our wrestle was of how do we convince, you know, employers to, we don't have as many connections within the community to employers at this point in time. Mm-hmm. And so how do we convince employers to want to hop on? And just like Andrea mentioned, I think the piece of providing, you know, support both to the employer on how to walk with our youth and then also for the youth and how to develop their job skills once they're in that employment is a great opportunity for that business. And I think one thing we've noticed is I think the heart for us and why I wanted to develop that is we have youth that are, you know, in jobs in our near our locations. And it would just, we found like, oh gosh, it would be so helpful to be able to talk to their boss just to kind of like see how they're doing and see if we can provide any feedback. But at this point, because that relationship isn't established, we don't want to overstep our boundary, you know, and be more involved than we should and kind of help them learn some of those lessons on their own and be there to help navigate on the back end. But I think just finding bosses that are going to be understanding to our youth and just to some of the, you know, just the different challenges that they struggle with, I think is really key. And that's something we've found to be hard. And so that's one, we have one established employment partner right now, but it's something that we're working on continuing to try to grow.
I don't know how this would happen, but if somehow you could identify former foster youth, right? Business owners, presidents, executives, managers, you know, it would be really interesting to find a way to somehow identify those who are former foster youth who would have that lived experience.
Yeah.
And potentially, I'm not saying they all would, but potentially the passion to help other young people because they've been through it.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, I don't know how it could happen, but wouldn't it be great if,
yes,
you know, you could look around your community and you could know who was in foster care. But because there's a stigma, I don't know that it's doable, but wow, that would be awesome.
Yeah. The employment partner that we do have right now, he was a foster alum. And so I think that's why that one has worked out so well thus far. So yeah, that would be a wonderful connection. And I think a great way to help those programs further along, as you said, because they have the experience and they would probably be a little more gracious and also just the passion and desire to help that population.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. I mean, you'd almost need to do some kind of mass mailing and just ask, right? Does anybody on your leadership team have foster care experience? We'd love to talk with them.
Yeah.
You know, something
yeah.
like that.
Yeah.
There you go. That's an idea.
I like
I'll throw
it.
That one out
there. I think that's great. I like it. There, you know, there is something that I would like to add, if you don't mind.
No, go for it.
So the young adults in our program, okay, I can't speak, you know, I can't speak highly enough about them because they too are, you know, they have this desire for entrepreneurship, but there's a strong desire to give back. A lot of the things that they identify, and these are people that are like recently graduated from our core program, but then also like the alum who've been in our program for years. I think that's one of the kind of benefits or highlights of our program is there's no exit date. There's no termination. So no formal closure process, right? People can stay in our program for as long as they need it. But going back, what I see is a lot of the young adults in the program just want to give back. You know, they have these really strong and deep desires to start a business and employ all foster youth. And so I think like tapping into that as a resource too. So maybe providing more entrepreneurial training, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for young adults.
Leadership skills.
Yeah.
All that.
Really, absolutely.
Actually, you made me think of the question of how long has the Right Way Foundation been working with transition age youth?
Since 2011, actually.
2011. Hope, how about your organization?
Our women's home started in 2014, and then our guys' house we opened in 2020.
Okay. So both of you have been doing this work for a few years now.
Mm-hmm.
That's great. So you certainly have the experience under your belt to be able to speak to all this. I did a podcast not too long ago where I interviewed cafes, right? Coffee houses that hire young people directly coming out of foster care. It's a whole different approach because they can, you know, watch the young people at work, right? They can teach them skills directly, work with them at the same time, coaching them, mentoring them toward their goals. But they have, you know, it's like they're around them all the time and they can see their young people at work in action. It's a little more challenging when the young people are working elsewhere because everything is, you know, third party reporting. I imagine that might be sometimes a challenge is that kind of he said, she said sort of problem where the employer is saying this happened, the young person saying that happened, and they don't necessarily match. Now, we're kind of already edging into the helping young people maintain employment, but that crossed my mind. How do you all work with that just to make sure that the lines of communications are open and that you're getting down to the truth of the matter?
That's a great question. Well, I think we start in with our core program, you know, all of the young adults in that, you know, wish to access services, we'll go through our core program, which is a 32-hour job readiness training that encompasses how to get a job and how to keep your job. So that how to keep your job piece, which is one of the reasons why we're here, is, you know, we're teaching young adults how to, you know, take care of themselves, right? Manage stress, manage their emotional health, their physical health, because these are all of the things that contribute to how you navigate work, right? The world of work. These things, your past experiences and the things that we've been through will have an impact on the way that you show up to work, right?
Mm-hmm.
Whether you socialize with your coworkers, how you maybe perceive the relationship with your supervisor. So we try to explore those during that 32-hour training. And we will also talk about issues like conflict resolution, problem solving, fundamental skills, right? How to problem solve, how to resolve conflict, how to communicate effectively, right? How to be active and compassionate listeners, and, you know, just how to manage in the work setting. So if there is an issue with an employer or a supervisor or a coworker, we're kind of navigating those skills in the job readiness training, but we're also letting them know if there is an issue that requires, you know, resolution or assistance with resolving, then like come back to us and let's problem solve together so we can figure out how to approach your employer, you know, because we want to empower youth to be able to kind of advocate for themselves in that space. So we're working alongside youth right at the core of our program when we're doing the training, and then we're kind of guiding them through as they navigate employment. We just try to be there to help resolve those issues if there, you know, one does arise.
Okay. Hope, how about your organization? How do you help promote the importance of that communication aspect?
Yeah, I think that's still a newer one for us just because we have most of the time they've had employment that we have not been connected to thus far. And so obviously we can, you know, when they come and share a struggle with work, we can help them work through it. from what we know based on their story, but we don't typically have contact with the employer. Like I said, that's something that we're kind of navigating now as we're starting to have those dual relationships. But typically, like Andrea said, just how do we teach them the skills to, you know, navigate conflict, to navigate having appropriate boundaries at work while also being a team player and a good employee, and, you know, and just what do those things look like? We have a life skills series that we do on communication. It's called I Said This, You Heard That, and it kind of goes through, there's four colors of communication, and so they learn about their color and other people's colors in our program, and then we talk to them about how does this apply to the work scenario, and, you know, how would you use these skills other places as well. So I think a lot of the maintenance pieces, teaching them the soft skills of, like she said, conflict, and how do you be appropriately assertive, what does being a good team player look like, and those kinds of things.
Yeah. I think that communication model that shows, of course, you've got somebody saying something, and then there's a filter that each individual has based on experience and so forth, and then what's actually heard based, you know, after that. It's that filter and helping young people understand what their filters might be influenced by. I could see that as being critical.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Now, would you say that these interpersonal and emotional skills, the soft skills, like you said, are they more important than the job skills themselves? And if so, why?
That's a good question. I think they're probably both important for different reasons. I think you have to have, you know, the resume, the cover letter, you know, how do you interview? We also encourage our residents to print off the resume, to go in person, to introduce themselves, because with all the online applications, it's easy to get lost in the shuffle. And so we talk about how do you make yourself stand out, and how do you, you know, even you apply online first and then you go in and you say, hey, I've already filled out the application. This is my name. I just wanted to introduce myself. We found a lot of success that way too. So I think those are just as important as then also, you know, because if you get the job, you know, you have to have those skills to get the job, but then the soft skills kind of come on the latter half to maintain the job. So I think they both work in tandem, and they just, the strong points of them are at different times.
Okay. Now, the Right Way Foundation, I'm thinking back to when I first met Franco and he was explaining how you all got started. Now, I might be telling it wrong, so correct me, Andrea, if I do. But my recollection is that it started as basically a job placement for youth aging out of foster care, and he had hired people who were skilled at job placement. But then because of the challenges that young people face after they get a job, the interpersonal, the filter challenges, and, you know, taking things the wrong way or responding emotionally, that kind of thing, that it was tough for young people to maintain the jobs. They would quit at the drop of a hat, or they would be let go. And so if I remember correctly, they shifted their model and changed to more of a counselor type of approach first, who then can place young people in jobs, right? So it isn't the mindset of the job placement professional. It's the mindset of the social worker slash counselor slash mentor, if you will. And then you also place young people in jobs. So did I get that correctly?
Yeah, so that is correct. It's really about utilizing our model of having a, you know, social worker. In our case, it's a social worker, an MSW or an LCSW like myself, really in that position to support people in preparation for employment. And, you know, that comes with obviously a variety of supports, right? Mental health support, emotional support, you know, taking those deep dives into a person, maybe understanding their triggers and exploring their trauma and their experiences, and really getting them ready to keep their jobs, you know, get a job and to keep their jobs.
Yes, absolutely. And to change your model, I imagine you probably had to let people go and then hire new staff, you know, new employees. So that's a big change to just do that turnaround like that. So I admire that he made that decision, and because it sounds like it's absolutely the right way to go for your organization. Hope, how about your organization? How do you manage hiring your staff, your employees? Do you look for particular backgrounds?
So we have a pretty small staff. We have myself, I direct our girls' home, and then we have a director over the guys' home, and then we have house managers for each location, and that's our team for the most part.
Okay.
And so the one thing that we kind of call ourselves like the boutique of transitional living, and so Because we are small, we can really give tailored individual attention to the residents in our program. We've seen, you know, sometimes kids come from other organizations and they've even maybe graduated a program, but because they just have a lot of people they're serving, maybe the depth of the support after they've transitioned out of that program hasn't been able to be provided. And so they've fallen back into kind of needing help again. And so our goal is to really make kids that are in our program, this is their last stop. And so, you know, they don't need a program after us. We have aftercare support for them after they've graduated our program to continue to help them navigate adulting and life. We kind of have our catchphrase is adulting is hard. And so we love to talk with them about how do we help make that less hard. And so, yeah, so I think one of the unique things about just because we only have 3 youth at each home and we are smaller, it enables us to kind of build a depth of relationship, and our staff kind of have a multifaceted job in kind of helping them in a variety of areas.
Well, that's great. I mean, I think that some people have a perception that if you're a small organization that, you know, you should grow, right? You should expand, you should grow. And some organizations do, and they do an amazing job at it. But I'm a big proponent of if you're a smaller organization and you find your niche and you do it really, really well, I don't know that there's necessarily a requirement to go big, right? Just keep focusing on what you're focusing on and do it well, right?
Yeah, that's been one of our goals. I think we're always open to growth, but we also want to be, like you said, able to really be competent in what we are providing and offer really solid services. And then if we are able to grow from there, great, but we don't ever want to lose that depth of our service for sure.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Andrea, how many employees do you have? I'm trying to get a sense of how big you are, or how many youth do you support?
So we currently have 12 employees. Annually, we serve 125 young adults, and that's 50 newly enrolled youth, and then 75 alumni.
You know, I think regardless of what an organization's focus is, whether it's employment, housing, education, life skills, whatever it may be, mentoring, there is value in having all of those services wrap around a young person, but you don't have to do it all, right? You find the organizations that do those other things and then partner with them. You refer young people to them, they refer their services to you. That's certainly one way that you can provide those other supports that they need. But I think with the cost of housing too, that the transitional housing is becoming more and more of an issue, especially in areas like yours, Andrea. And I don't know about Plano, Texas, what your housing situation is, but I know in California, it's out of this world how expensive. In New York, you know, those areas is so expensive.
Yeah, it's definitely gone up since I've been with Germerlin Outreach and helping residents find apartments. You know, when they're finishing our program, the cost has definitely increased a lot in my time. So I would agree. It's getting harder and harder to find affordable options for them when they graduate. And most are having to do roommates or things like that at this point.
Oh, yeah. So how does that impact a young person? Let's say they have a job. They've come out of foster care, they have a job, but then they're in a housing crisis all of a sudden. And I don't mean the nation's housing crisis, their own housing crisis. You know, somehow they are there without a place to live. That impacts everything, doesn't it? How do you help a young person in that situation in regard to employment? Because this goes along with helping them maintain employment. It helps them, you know, you have to make sure they have transportation. You have to make sure that they have a place to live. Otherwise, they might quit their job and end up homeless. You know, it's just, how do you do that? They all have to fall together.
Yeah, I think we offer, our main program is housing. So I think the youth that we are helping have housing with us. And so that does help. But I would imagine, yeah, if the housing falls through, you know, how do you maintain a job when you don't have somewhere to live and have that stability? So I would assume that the housing has to come first.
Yeah, so housing, I feel like, and any other basic needs, right, they do have to come first. That should be the priority. It's going to be really challenging for a person to maintain employment. It's even going to be challenging for a person to stay engaged in a supportive service like therapy or mental health support if housing is not stable or any other basic needs aren't met. Yeah.
Right. And not only is it the stress of not having the housing, it's also where they actually physically are.
Right.
Right. Depending on where they're bouncing around, they might be couch surfing, they might be on the street.
Mm-hmm.
So that in and of itself poses problems. How do they get to work from wherever it is that they end up?
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely. And I mean, you know, obviously not all housing programs or types of housing are created the same. And so, you know, having to consider where we're placing people in housing is a priority as well, because we don't want to set people up in a way where, let's say, they have trauma from being in shelter, right? We don't want to place them in a shelter knowing that they might have a lot of trauma that comes with it because of their experience living in a shelter. So,
yeah, right. That's true.
Right. Really considering a person's individualized housing needs.
But then if you don't have an income, how do you get housing? Really, that's why I said they just seem to go hand in hand.
Right. Yeah, definitely. They do go hand in hand. And this is why I think housing options and exploring and individualizing housing options is really important, because there are some programs that really do operate in that housing first model where it's, we'll get somebody housed and then we'll work on job opportunities, employment opportunities, school, education. And so they're not necessarily requiring an income at first. That'll sort of be the ultimate goal. And there'll be a time frame to get a person employed or put into some sort of career or, you know, educational program or anything like that. But absolutely, like, they do go hand in hand. And going back to what I said earlier, which is like, that's why individualized support is so important, right? We can't really expect that somebody who doesn't have employment, doesn't have income, to be able to afford housing right off the bat. That's something that you have to work towards.
Right.
I've seen as well more of a trend starting now to where there's houses that are owned by companies that will rent out rooms. And so a lot of times, even if a youth maybe don't have, as long as they have a little bit of savings, it's usually like a month to month payment for that room. And so they can, you know, if they can get into that and then at least have a little bit of savings to do the first month, then if they can find a job within that month and then continue to pay, that sometimes is a way to do that as well.
Yeah. I just saw a video on YouTube this past week, and I think it was in New York, that they're starting to explore for affordable housing. And I don't know if this is certainly the answer. It's kind of interesting. I don't know how I feel about it, but they're building these communal living buildings. Picture a dorm type of situation where you have a lot of rooms, a shared kitchen, a shared living room, right? That kind of thing. And they're renovating these big buildings. Maybe they were commercial at one point and they're renovating them into these types of living. Now, it's not necessarily for young people aging out of foster care, but it's supposed to be more affordable, right? Because you're just renting the room and then you have the shared space. It's kind of an interesting model. How do you think that might work with young people coming out of foster care? Because a lot of young folks have come from group homes and may have had issues with group homes too.
Yeah, and that's a good point too. I mean, and that kind of goes back to what we were saying earlier about the need to have very individualized, you know, assessments or evaluations or just like very individualized needs, right? Like meeting people where they're at, learning about what options are going to work best for them. And I understand that housing is limited, you know, housing options are limited, but I think it is beneficial to learn about what a young person needs in terms of the housing setting. So while this particular setup that you referenced in New York City might work for some, even those coming out of a group home, it might not work for everybody. But, you know, we have to have those preliminary conversations to determine whether that is the right fit for a specific person. I think it definitely could work, right? And there's some people that, like, you know, through our program who have identified, I don't want to live alone. I can't live alone. I mean, a community setting is something that's really beneficial for my mental health. And then there are others who are like, I can't have roommates. I can't live with anybody else. You know, I need to fly solo. And we're like, yeah, I totally get that.
Yeah. I wonder, especially in cities like New York City, I'm seeing solutions like this for housing in general, right? Not necessarily for young people aging out of foster care.
Mm-hmm.
And it just seems like it could be an interesting government nonprofit partnership to, one, get the structures, whatever they may be, a variety of different structures, and then partner with nonprofits to have that customized assignment, mm-hmm. if you will. Because I don't know that the foster care system, the way that it works, could really be flexible or nimble enough to handle the customization part of it. What do you think?
Yeah, that's a great point. And I think that's why our county's Department of Children and Family Services does rely on community-based organizations to provide that supplemental support, because they can't, obviously they can't do it all. You know, they're so impacted with children and young people that it would, you know, that's a task that they wouldn't be able to take on alone. And so I think that's why they do rely heavily on community-based organizations, again, to provide those supplemental services. You know, if they could at least provide the housing, the structure, like you said, and then contract with other CBOs to go in and provide the supports, whether, you know, the employment support, the one-on-one job coaching, mental health, all of that, then I think a model like that could definitely be successful.
I think so too.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I don't mean to go too far into housing and get off the track of employment, but again, I feel like they go hand in hand. And so I'll just say that I think for anyone listening, if you're thinking about starting an organization, transitional housing, I don't know how much money is out there in grants and so forth, but transitional housing is a huge need. So I'll encourage folks to go that direction. But how about transportation? I had mentioned that. How do you help young people with transportation and getting to their jobs? I mean, depending on where you are, you might have public transportation, but how do you all handle that? Because that's another important element.
Yeah, we have typically three kind of transition buckets to help them get to work. One would be where our houses are located. There are a decent amount of employment opportunities within walking distance. So initially they may walk. We also offer bikes that they can use if they want to go a little further distance. And then obviously while they're working close to our locations, we teach them how to build up a savings and look towards purchasing a vehicle, which then enables them to go farther out. We do have some public transportation in our area, but it just kind of is depending on, it doesn't go all the places that they need to go sometimes. So, and then I think Lyft and Uber are options. Obviously, it's a more expensive choice, but it does really help. And if you're going to the same location repetitively, they tend to give you a discount.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that. Mm-hmm. All right. Andrea, how about you?
So the need for transportation is obviously in demand, especially I think in LA County, with Los Angeles and the surrounding area being so spread out that, you know, efficient transportation is really important. And, you know, public transportation isn't always the most efficient if you're getting across the county. And so I think the reality is a lot of people in this area need to have a car to get to and from wherever they need to go. And although that's probably not the most practical solution, it's, you know, in terms of like financially, it's something that is necessary almost, especially when you're trying to commute to and from work and it could take you an hour and a half just to get to work, right? If you're in a car. So, and then, you know, like add kids on top of that, if you're dropping them off to school in other locations, right? And it's not close to work, you have to factor that into consideration. But again, the reality is that, you know, we do need cars in where we live to get to and from. And I know our public transportation system isn't the best. Again, it's not the most efficient, but that is definitely an option. And so what we do is we help young people get their license. You know, we get grants to support driver's education or driver's training so they get behind the wheel experience and, you know, can get a car to take the test at the DMV. So, you know, that's covered. But then we're also working with our financial coach to go over all the things that are required to get a car, right? Because it's not just about getting the vehicle itself. It's you got to get the license and you have to get the insurance and the registration and all of the anticipated and unanticipated expenses that go into owning a car. So that's an option, but we're talking about everything that one would need in order to keep that car. And then we also do provide Uber and Lyft rides because we understand those are expensive and, you know, it's not something that's easily accessible to most people because of the expense. So we'll provide Uber and Lyft rides if necessary. We'll provide bus passes if necessary.
Yeah, I would imagine so. And looking to the future, right, when they're no longer participating in your program, they're going to need their own transportation at some point. Maybe a scooter. Get a scooter if it's not too far. Okay. Well, I know transportation, like I said, is one of the important elements. What are other elements that need to be in place for young people for them to be able to maintain their jobs that we haven't mentioned yet?
I think some of the, you know, other elements that we need to address when it comes to jobs are things like, you know, mental health and well-being and those kinds of supports. And kind of going back a little bit. So our initial program, it's the program that every young adult goes through before accessing the remainder of our supportive services, is called Operation Emancipation. And that's our trauma-informed job readiness program. So we not only talk about the elements that are important to getting a job, right? All the things that are important, interview skills and how to fill out an application and maybe, you know, how to build your resume and things like that, but also those critical elements important to keeping your job and job retention, you know, learning about how to manage your triggers, how to manage stress, how to manage stress responses, sort of understanding the ways in which our own past experiences and trauma and how they impact how we maybe show up to work, right? Whether we show up to work on time, whether we socialize with our coworkers, right? So those experiences do impact those things in our current behavior and our work behavior. And so we talk about all of those. We talk about conflict resolution and problem solving and communication skills, you know, again, all the things that are important in maintaining employment. And so I think those things need to go hand in hand. And that's actually just something that we've learned just by doing this work is, you know, you can't have conversations about jobs and job training and job readiness without having a conversation about mental health and well-being.
And so much of that overlaps other areas of our life too, right? Yeah. Not just the job.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. And we do talk about that too. Like, these are skills and this is stuff that you'll need in your personal and professional lives. So, Yeah.
I would imagine so. I remember when I was working at Milton Hershey School, I was there for about 14 years. And one of the programs that we all took was called Therapeutic Crisis Intervention through Cornell University. And it was a way to help young people talk through when they have some kind of emotional situation that they faced. So after they've calmed down a little bit, you help them think through why they think they were triggered and their initial reaction to it. Think through alternatives to, you know, if you're faced with the same kind of trigger in the future, how else could you manage that? What are some other things that you can do? And then you come to an agreement with that young person. And then should it happen again, you know, you talk to them again and you coach them again. So I would imagine something like that would be what you're doing there at your organization. I'm saying just one part of it, but helping young people learn how to react effectively to situations that might otherwise trigger them.
Right. And what I was previously saying about teaching young adults those skills that are necessary to keeping their jobs, right? The stress management piece of things, the how to identify and become aware of your triggers, doing that exploring and the deep dives into those things in order to be able to manage them while on the job, right? Because the employment setting could potentially be a triggering place, right? Maybe there's a supervisor or a coworker that reminds you of someone that, you know, might have not treated you so well in the past. And so being aware of those things is really important, right? Because again, the work setting can be a very triggering place. And so, you know, bringing awareness to those types of things is really important. That's why we do what we do in those job readiness trainings. But that's also why we run trainings for our employer partners about the ways in which trauma impact people, right? And how to be sort of like sensitive and open-minded about those kinds of things and just really teaching them about everybody's experience is differently, right? Everybody can show up to work differently. That doesn't mean that they're not going to be a good employee, or that doesn't mean that they have potential to be a good employee. It just means people show up differently because of things that they've been through, of experiences they've had, both previously and currently. And so just to be aware of that, bring an awareness to it, and be a little bit more sensitive and empathetic towards your employees.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, both sides need to have that awareness.
Yes.
The youth need to be aware that they have triggers that maybe they don't even recognize yet.
Mm-hmm.
And to be observant of when something triggers them, that they can identify what it was and talk through it. And then the employer, like you're saying, to have patience, because if the young person hasn't been coached through a trigger, or isn't having a good day,
yeah,
and they're not managing themselves well, their emotions very well, then the employer just needs to be more understanding than maybe they otherwise would be.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Hopefully they'd be understanding in with all employees, but
right. And that's what I was that's what I was going to say, Lynn, is like, this applies to anybody in an employment setting, right? Like, because we can all have a bad day. We've all been through things. I mean,
sure.
You know, maybe we do have that a coworker who's dealing with housing instability, right? And that's obviously affecting them at work. So just being like in tuned or attuned to those kinds of things and sensitive and again, empathetic. Yeah.
Exactly. Well, why do you think, I'll pose this question to you both. What are some common reasons that young people either leave a job or are let go after they've gotten one?
I think one thing we've noticed is, and one thing we've tried to work on is help them have proper expectations for work. So sometimes I think they may leave because they want a higher pay than what they're getting, or there's just something about what they expected the work environment to be like that's not how it's showing up for them. So helping them to recognize what is proper expectations of work, what is expected of you, what is expected of a boss and people that lead you. I think the things we've seen the most are, you know, just tense relationships with either a coworker or a boss and things that felt like they were not able to work through. Those are probably the main things that I've seen.
Maybe a little along the lines of those interpersonal skills, the relationship part of it. Okay. How about you, Andrea? What do you think?
So I think that having realistic expectations or having those conversations is definitely really important, like Hope says. But I mean, even sometimes after those conversations, I think there's still potentially a different expectation going into a job. So sometimes those challenges can't always be avoided despite the conversations we have, especially when, you know, a person might be in survival mode and is just like, I just need a job right now because I need income and I'm willing to take any job that I can get, right? And then once they get into that job, it's maybe something that they learn that is not what they expected or is not something they really want to do. And so they end up maybe leaving that job. And I mean, even through coaching of like, well, you know, maybe it's best to have a job before you quit your current job. Even through the coaching and those conversations, sometimes that's not always the case. You know, it's not always going to be set up that way. So, you know, I also think there's other factors like maybe childcare being an issue, right? Like if your child is sick, you can't take them to childcare, which means that you miss out on a day of work. And, you know, not employers are always amenable to issues with childcare. They're not always understanding. And I think the reality is if you're calling off of work because your child is sick and can't go to daycare, sometimes, you know, if an employer has difficulty covering a shift, you know, the employer is going to feel a certain type of way and maybe treat that employee who had to call off a certain type of way, right? Not so great. And the employee is going to feel that tension and feel that there's a completely different, you know, disposition from this person and, you know, feel really uncomfortable. And maybe that's a reason to leave a job. So,
yeah. Right. Do you think these are issues that are unique to young people coming out of foster care? Or do you think it's just young people that maybe that's fairly common, these challenges?
I think that these issues are definitely not unique to foster care youth. I think they're, you know, they can be obviously found amongst youth in general. But I do think that there are, you know, some needs that foster youth might face or experience differently. And I think, and I'm just going to reference the childcare one because I work with a lot of parents and, you know, someone like myself, and obviously I'm not a young person, but someone like myself.
Me neither. It's been a long time since I've been a young person.
Likewise. I'm okay with it. You know, and I do have children and I have older children. They're not adult children, but I have older children. But I do have the privilege of if I needed to call for childcare support, I have that support. You know, maybe I need to call my mom or my husband and I have that support. And I don't think that just in learning about, you know, our young people's experiences that they don't always have that support system in place. You know, and again, like I have the privilege of being able to call on my support system to provide childcare if I needed to leave my child somewhere and go to work or go somewhere.
Yeah.
Right. So I think that's maybe where there's a little bit of that like issues unique to foster youth might be.
Right.
Mm-hmm. When it comes to support system. Yeah.
Yeah. That makes sense. Yeah. I think the whole expectations of a job of, you know, making a certain amount or having a work environment be a particular way. I think that's kind of a Gen Z thing. I'm generalizing, of course, not everybody, but I think it's a younger person expectation. You know, when I was young, because I'm like, what, 56 now, you would just go get an entry-level job, and that's what you did. And you would do it, and you'd work your way up. And there was just really no questioning it. And I think today, the young people are really looking much more at the meaningfulness of it. You know, they're looking at other things besides just, you know, I'm going in the bottom, and I'm going to work my way up, and that's just the way it is.
One thing we've had to encourage our youth to think about is this first job may not be your ideal job, but, you know, but learning how to create a trajectory. And so right now, our main focus is that you build up some savings and learn how to manage money. And so this job may not be the exact type of career field that you want, but it meets the present need, which is helping you gain income. And while you have this job, then you can continue to look for a different job that may better fit what you're looking to do long term. But I think a lot of them are stuck on, you know, when I get this first job, I want it to be in this field. And so we've had to work on, you know, like what's the point? You know, different jobs serve different purposes. And so for right now, the purpose of this job is to help you gain income and learn the financial skills to be able to continue to build savings and those types of things. And hopefully, you know, it'd be great if all of it came at the same time, but, you know, you still can learn other skills at this job that will help you in the next one. And hopefully your next one can be maybe more aligned with the career field that you're looking at. But that's one thing that we have to help them think through as well.
Yeah. I'll ask one follow-up question to that. And then it looks like we probably should wrap up. Do you think it's a different generational mindset about delayed gratification?
Yes.
I was wondering if we could kind of explain it that way. Is it a lack of, I don't want to say, they certainly would know what delayed gratification is, but is it an impatience? What do you think it is?
I would think maybe it's what we've seen, at least, is kind of an inability to think long-term and more a focus on short-term, you know, what sounds good in the moment. So I think their ability to kind of plan and to have that long-term view, I think, is a little bit more difficult.
What do you think, Andrea?
Yeah, I think things are so easily accessible now. You don't have to wait for anything. You know, it's like at a touch of a button, I can have something delivered to me within a couple of hours, within the hour, that same day. And so I don't have to wait for any length of time.
Right. And you get answers immediately through Google versus having to go to a library, say.
Yeah, exactly.
I remember the days where you would go to an encyclopedia to get an answer.
I do too.
It's like that delayed gratification. The gratification is instant or very fast in today's world.
Right.
And I think maybe young people are being conditioned to expect that.
Yeah, exactly. Without even having to leave my house.
That's right. Oh, another good point, right?
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We had mail order catalogs back when I was young, but, you know, you could potentially wait weeks, you know, for what it is that you ordered, and then you'd have to find it in the catalog, and who knows if they would have what you want. And it was just a different world. And we didn't have credit cards like we do now back then. I mean, there were credit cards, but it's not like they would give them out to kids. It was just a different world. And so you'd have to earn the cash to be able to do what you wanted to do. And now with credit, and like you're saying, just we're so used to getting things so quickly. It's just changed, I think, the expectations. So I agree. Well, I hate to bring this to a close because I really have enjoyed this conversation, but we probably should wrap things up. Hope and Andrea, thank you so much for joining this conversation. It has been wonderful. And I wish you all the best continuing the work that you're doing with these young people. And hopefully maybe, you know, down the road, we can come back together and have a different conversation. But for now, this has been awesome.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you so much, Lynn, for hosting this conversation.
You're very welcome. Well, for everybody who's listened to this podcast to the very end, thank you very much. We put out a podcast every couple of weeks or so. You can find them on our website, agingoutinstitute.org. And then look for the podcast link in the menu. We have 4 years of podcasts, so there are plenty there for you to listen to. So again, Hope and Andrea, thank you very much. And for everyone else, we'll talk to you next time.